The podcast you're about to listen to contains graphic details that some listeners may find disturbing. With that being said, listener discretion is advised. And if you are to proceed, buckle up, my skeptics. In modern times, our phones are a great sense of comfort. The thing we often go to when we are in need of a laugh, to escape with a game, and to catch up with friends. But for Dorothy Jane Scott in the 1980s, it was a thing of terror. It all began in Stanton, California, where Dorothy lived with her 4-year-old son and aunt. Many friends and family members said that she lived a very plain and normal life, devoted to her church, family, and a few close friends that she had. She was generally an all-around caring person, people said, which would tragically lead to her strange disappearance. A lot of the information I took was from Medium, but based on an account from there, her father, Jacob Scott, mentioned her never having a steady boyfriend around the time of her disappearance, although it was said that she had some steady dates, so I assume at the time it would have been hard to find a suspect out of that situation. She was also stated as being quite a hard worker, and during the time of her disappearance, she had worked 2 jobs, one being at Springer Psych Shop and another at Custom John's Head Shop, which sounds like very odd names, but they were all stores whom clients were into the like hippie sort of lifestyle. And both businesses were jointly owned by her father, in which she worked as a secretary for them, and conveniently located near Anaheim, because while she worked those jobs, her parents would watch their grandson. You'd think a life like that, being a single parent and working 2 jobs, that trouble wouldn't have found her, or had time to rather, but it unfortunately would. And that was the mystery many to this day are left wondering, who and why. But from my research, I couldn't find a specific date the odd occurrences had began. But it was stated months prior to the kidnapping, she started receiving mysterious phone calls. It was described by her as someone who was stalking, and in the same senses, would be showing great affection, and then with the drop of a dime, menacing threats, often even detailing her day-to-day behaviors, such as whom she was talking to, what she was wearing, and just the other mundane things. The most alarming and maybe telling of what was to come was a call by the man whom she had mentioned to her mother as being a voice she recognized but couldn't place. He was quoted by her to have said that he was going to get her alone and cut her into bits so no one could ever find her. I know what you may be thinking, this can't be real and literally some Hollywood script, but that's sadly not the case for this story. She kept receiving calls, one telling her to go outside, and when she did, she had discovered a dead rose on her car. I never saw any reports that she involved the police in the beginning, but it also would have probably not have been taken serious from the police due to the fact that it wasn't considered an illegal activity until actually the 1990s, which was first legalized in the United States starting in California. But before I go into theories of possible suspects, I'll continue with the tragic tale. After dealing with the harassing phone calls, according to her mother, she began taking self-defense lessons and had considered arming herself with a weapon. But it was reported she didn't go ahead with the latter due to her having a young child. You know, as any parent would probably fear, she had feared for her son harming himself potentially. With the call still continuing, detailing her everyday motions from what she was wearing, where she had been, and what she had ate, the menacing caller seemed to have gotten great pleasure from monitoring her and the power he got from the initial terrorizing. But as most cases like this, escalation was bound to happen. And soon, that was just what happened. On May 28th, 1980, everything out of the ordinary seemed to have happened, except Dorothy's kindness and concerned nature. On the day of her disappearance, she had noticed during a meeting, one of her coworkers, Conrad Bostrom, didn't look well. He was turning pale, sweating, and it seemed to have been worsening by the minute. And then, that's when she noticed a red mark that was swelling on his arm and decided she should rush him to the emergency room. When she had made the offer, another coworker named Pam Head had agreed to accompany them on this trip. But before stopping at the hospital, since as mentioned before, her parents would watch her child, she stopped there to tell them of the trip, and when she switched, oddly enough, from her black scarf into her red scarf. And then she carried on with the trip. What was soon to have been discovered to be the cause of failing health at the hospital was a bite of a black widow spider. What are the odds? During the time of the visit, Pam and Dorothy were keeping each other company and chatting as one does, which when questioned later by the police, Pam would mention nothing out of the ordinary being mentioned by Dorothy that would give any clues, and they basically stayed by each other the entire time. But after the diagnosis was given and the prescriptions were written for Conrad, they went in the line to wait. But upon realizing that she could make it easier, Dorothy decided she would go to her car and pull it forward to the entrance. They never could have guessed that would be the last encounter with Dorothy they would ever have. In the darkness outside of the hospital, Conrad and Pam had waited a few moments for Dorothy to pull up. There was no sign of her, and that's when the worry began to set in. It shouldn't have taken so long, they had thought, but then their worries quickly eased when they saw her 1973 white Toyota station wagon approaching, but in an odd manner, the high beams appeared to be on, and as they were signaling for the presence to be seen, the vehicle, without them seeing who was driving because of the lights blinding them, sped by and took a right turn, and then the lights went off. Stunned by the scene, they maybe thought an emergency had come up involving her son, and it being the 80s, they had no way of calling her to see if everything was okay, because no cell phones existed. So they waited and waited until a couple hours went by. Not seeing any sign of her return, they eventually called Dorothy's parents, Vera and Jacob Scott. But when they asked Vera and Jacob if they had seen Dorothy, they said the only moment they saw her was when she stopped to tell them of the trip. It was just a brief encounter. So quickly the police were also notified, which, shocker, did nothing during the calls around this time. With certain protocols not in place at the time, it made events like this way harder to be taken seriously. But not far from these events, an eerie discovery would be made. Just 10 miles and several hours of time from the hospital event, her car was found in Santa Ana on fire. There was still hope for the family because her body was not found at the scene, but an immediate investigation then began. But now the police wanted the parents to keep silent and not speak to any press, which could be a smart tactic if you want to keep certain information private to weed out any false confessions. So, just when the family thought they had dealt with the potential hardest day possible, a week after the car being discovered, a horrid phone call would start the terror all over. An unknown male asked Vera as she answered the phone, "Are you related to Dorothy Scott?" To which Vera said, reluctant, "Yes." Then the man on the phone just simply said, "I've got her," and just hung the phone up. After constant calls, they decided it was time to stop the silence, and they went to the newspapers with the story. And this could have been a horrible prank. After it was published, though, a caller called and told the editor, Paul Riley of Santa Ana Register newspaper, "I killed her." As the details kept going, he said, "I killed Dorothy Scott. She was my love. I caught her cheating with another man. She denied having someone, so I killed her." Details that weren't clear as to how they were brought up into the conversation led to the killer or just caller mentioning that they knew the scarf she was wearing and that the coworker suffered a spider bite. With details of infidelity, clear suspects would arise, such as her ex and the father of her son, but both were cleared of any wrongdoing due to an alibi. The calls weren't done as one would hope, because on every Wednesday, Vera's mother would receive a phone call saying, "Is Dorothy there? I've got her. I've killed her." Now, the home was being traced with calls due to that being the best lead, but the caller always hung up to the phone before it could be traced. Years would go by and still the calls would persist. 4 years to be exact. And on that fourth year, on August 6, 1984, a construction worker discovered a grisly sight. The skeletal remains of a human body underneath a deceased dog. The human remains that were still present were a human skull, pelvis, two thigh bones, and an arm. Some items that belonged to the victim were nearby as well. A turquoise ring and a watch that stopped working on May 29th, 1980 at 12:30 a.m., which was roughly around the time she disappeared. After the papers reported on the discovery of the body, the final call would come to the family on a late night when this time it wasn't Vera who would answer, but Jacob Scott. And the killer didn't say anything and only hung up the phone. The family finally got to experience some relief in not having the menacing calls continue, but live the rest of their lives, sadly not knowing who tragically took the life of their beloved, caring, and selfless daughter. The memory of her life before the horror did stay with them, and I like to think that kept them with some bit of comfort. Sadly, Jacob Scott passed away in 1994 and Vera Scott in 2002. Her son, Sean, would still continue to fight for justice and try to figure out who kidnapped and murdered his mother, which leads us to the theories. And I want to reiterate just that, their theories. Nothing I will say is based on evidence that would prove them guilty, but things I do find hard to let go. Suspect number one you'll hear float around is Mike Butler. He was a patron of a location Dorothy had worked, and also the brother of a co-worker of hers. So that could also be why she recognized the voice and just couldn't place it, and also could explain how he knew the phone number and her schedule, and it just wouldn't even go noticed seeing him around, knowing that his relative worked there. And it also could explain why Dorothy's father, when he answered the phone, he immediately hung up in fear maybe that the voice would be recognized, because if the co-worker that he was the brother of still worked at the shop, then I would assume he would still be coming by. But that's just a theory, and one that also Dorothy's son, Sean, believes. Another possibility was the potential that it could have been someone who worked at an auto shop across the street from her work. If you think about that, we often interact with people in ways that we just might not think of, but you know, it's a place she would frequently visit, so she could have heard the person's voice there. Also, it was such an odd detail that before she went to take Conrad to the hospital, she stopped home to change from her black scarf to red. Was there someone whom she potentially had plans later with that required this, like a sign of who she is? Or was it just a casual last-minute decision? How did this person know about the bite on Conrad? It'd be such an intimate detail, and one that I guess could have been interrogated out of her upon her capture. It was never clear how long she was kept alive after being taken from the hospital. And also some theories that I read from the internet sleuths online even wondered if maybe after Dorothy went to her car, maybe there was like a note on the car indicating that something was gonna happen to her son if she didn't go to this location, which would also explain the unconventional nature of her being abducted in a parking lot at a hospital. To me, this explains more potentially on how she went without a fight that we know of, and how the killer would have been able to burn her car and seemingly escape quickly after doing something like that. That would assuredly cause quick attention and be harder to escape on foot. All of this to say, though, is we still don't have any clues as to what may have occurred, and it remains one of those mysteries that just haunts you. With that being said, though, I'm curious to know any possible theories you guys may have had upon me telling you this, or like research that you guys might do after. And maybe together, skeptics, we can help lead investigators on the right track to something that's sadly been cold for too long.